I'm right in the middle of editing a feature, and I've got 40 minutes of that done. And I'm trying to put together a Broadway show. It's one of the reasons why I'm here this week, because I have meetings with various people trying to get that thing organized.
So I imagine then that you're not going to be able to tell us much about the show.
That's right. Or about the feature.
About the feature.
But I can tell you what I did last week. I did a show called Fairy Tale Theater. You ever heard of it? Yeah. I played a hunchback. And it was a lot of fun. Boy, the costume was so itchy. Oy. And I wound up going face down into a plate of mashed potatoes. I was a comedy hunchback.
And I was ugly once.
Bet you weren't as ugly as I was.
No. Look at it.
Well, they fixed me up pretty good. First of all, I had to wear this elasticized body stocking with a permanently installed hunch. And then on top of that, they had this itchy, scratchy wool thing that went over it, matching wool pants and smock on the top and a big belt. And I was supposed to be Attila, the hunchbacked Hungarian bellhop, so I had this medieval bellhop hat with a feather sticking out of it. It was a pretty stupid costume. There'll be a volume two. That's a pretty good implication. And volume two, the release date of volume two is still in question because I have some rock and roll project that I have to complete before I go back to work on the rest of that. Volume two needs to be edited and mixed.
So,
yeah.
So how do you swing around between this kind of music and rock and roll? Is it difficult?
No. Not for me, anyway.
Both in the course of a day?
Yeah. I could do them on the same album, but the reason I didn't do mix and match on this album is I figured that for an initial release of something that's this different from the rest of the stuff that I've done, I figured that I wouldn't confuse anybody and leave it all with acoustic instruments. There's nothing electronic on the album. And it's possible that Volume 2 will have a combination of what the LSO played and either some electronic music that I've been working on or some selections that have performances by the band.
Is one style of music more rewarding for you personally?
No, I'm delighted any time any piece of music gets played, especially if it's played right. That's always the thing to shoot for. It's always the hardest thing to get. Well, that's only
rock and roll, there's nothing to that.
For being too old for rock and roll?
Yeah.
Oh, I was always too old for rock and roll. I was born too old for rock and roll. And what I've been doing for the last 20 years has been so on the fringe of what most people would call rock and roll. Some people didn't even think I was ever in rock and roll. So, you know, the ageism factor doesn't really enter into it. I mean, there's no way that I consider myself in competition with the rest of the rock and roll world. It's just it's a matter of no import to me what real rock and roll bands do and whether or not they're cool and whether or not I'm old. It doesn't make any difference at all. And as far as the album being a departure from the rock and roll world, it was never meant to be connected with it at all. It's a totally separate style of music, but provided for the amusement of people who ordinarily consume rock and roll, who might want to hear something different for a minute, there it is. But I still do music with electric guitars and drums and stuff.
So with that kind of lineup, will you see you on the road anytime soon?
No, you won't.
Anytime?
I don't have any plans to do any more touring with a rock and roll band. If I do any live concerts in the future, there'll be things with an orchestra or chamber music or something like that. I don't think that people are really that interested in that style of music coming from me. most people would rather go and see something else. And the cost to me to prepare a tour and rehearse a band and to subject my body to various types of punishment while I'm out there, as well as a number of months out of the year that I would have to devote to that, I just said, look, I've done it for 20 years, and there are at least a half a dozen other things for which I'm qualified to do, and I'll do those. There have been some discussions about having me conduct in various places later this fall, but they're not finalized yet. But as far as putting a band together and going out and playing the hockey rinks and stuff, no.
Well, you know, actually, I do have a question. You know, you were talking about the rock and roll versus, you know, other types of music that you do. Do you ever find that your rock and roll crowd, like, sort of inadvertently winds up at one of your other productions? Like, what kind of thing happens there? Is there like a friction?
No. Yeah. Usually, in the advertising for these events, if there is a live event like that, it's pretty specific, and I think that a person has got to know in advance so that they come to an event that involves an orchestra or a chamber ensemble or something like that. They have to know, unless they're so blitzed, they're immobilized, that there's not going to be any fuzz tone there or dynamo hum either. And I recently conducted in San Francisco an ensemble up there and some works by Berez. And there was a lot of rock and roll fans there, but they came there knowing that they were going to hear something other than rock and roll music. You know, you can't underestimate the desire in certain parts of the rock and roll consuming public to experience forms of music other than two chord progressions and four kick drum beats per bar. You know, there are curious people out there who want to find out if there is something else besides regular rock and roll. And it's not a matter of having to choose between one form of music or the other. You know, you don't have to choose up sides. Everything is there for you to enjoy. There are people who listen to rock and roll who also like country and western. There are people who listen to rock and roll who also like jazz. And there are people who listen to rock and roll who like Baroque music. Not large quantities in each of those things, but you can't have in your mind this fixed image of a rock and roll listener as some sort of zomboid mutant who wants only that. There are people who want variety, and to the degree that I can afford to do these projects, I provide types of variety that other people can listen to. You know, optional entertainment.
Your fans, what kind of music, they changed? Somebody was a fan of like Uncle Meat, you know, but that's still your fan today? Or?
Oh, I doubt it. I think that it's hard to get a profile of what a fan today would be, but usually what happens is a lot of people think that because I've been doing this for so long that my original fans and the interviewer's mental image of what a fan for an album like Freakout might have looked like, you know, some deranged, slobbering San Francisco type, you know, whatever, you have this fantasy in life, and if they really like you, they'll follow you for 20 years. It doesn't happen. These people grow up and they get a job and they go someplace, or they're still on the sidewalk drawing an eye with a tear coming out of it and with their hand out for nickels or something. You know, whatever happens to these people, they're gone. And each semester, there's a new bunch that comes in. Because the older these people get, the less they want to sit in a hockey rink and be puked on by somebody 15 years old. They don't want that. They're too evolved. And so the people who go to the hockey rink are going there not only to hear music, but they're going there because it's a social event. And they like to puke on each other. And that's part of, you know, what it's all about to grow up, you know. You don't puke, you don't grow. You know what I mean, Rex? Okay. So the people who consume what I do come in all different shapes and sizes, and they change semester by semester. And they've been getting younger.
Well, last semester you had a...
Very young last semester.
Yeah,
because of the Valley Girl record.
I know, I was casing out a year later. But, well, actually, most of the recent one had the effect it's had in your home family back to normal? Was that, I don't know what normal exactly is.
Well, the family's always as normal as it's ever going to be, but now Moon has her own manager, and she's pursuing a career in acting, and they send her scripts all the time, and she's done TV shows and things like that. Right now, she and Dweezil are working on an album. I hope to hear some finished tracks by the time I get home. Steve Vai, who is one of the guitar players in the band for the last couple of years, is producing this album. It's basically Dweezil's album, and Moon's going to do some vocals on it.
So, will we have any kind of involvement in maybe listen to some tracks and give opinion to more finished work? Or have you been involved in the...
What I'm going to do is I'm going to supervise the drum overdubs. And so by the time I get back, they've laid down rhythm tracks with a little rhythm machine. They're putting on all the guitars and stuff, and they'll probably have the vocals on. I'll get back, I'll listen to it, I'll bring in Chad Wackerman. We'll add real drums to it, take off the rhythm box, spiff up the rest, and I'll probably supervise the mix. But the supervision of how the pieces are being performed and, you know, all that kind of style stuff is what Steve Vai is doing while I'm here in New York. Rather than have my studio at home just sitting vacant, I said, Dweezil, go make a record. So he's in there.
Is Fred Zeppelin defunct?
Yeah, the band's just called Dweezil now.
Are you concerned at all about your kids getting swept up into the music business?
Swept up? What does that mean?
Well, they're kind of young compared to most of the people who are recording. Although, I guess there are other people in their age who are doing it.
Well,
you know, it's a different kind of lifestyle.
I'm not worried about it because I don't think age is a factor. I don't think they're too young to work. And I don't think I'm too old to work. So it's just a matter of what your attitude is toward what you're doing. They're not about to jump out on the road and go do a 30-city hockey rink tour. It's not like that. If they want to express themselves in music, I'll help them out and give them the opportunity and the tools to do that. As far as touring, they know and I know that they ain't going no place until they're old enough to handle that. I mean, right now, it's something that they do at home.
Well, so that's kind of the answer, because, you know, you've got the one hit, let's say it's another hit off this record, and, you know, there is that demand where you can sell those kind of tickets, then you would...
I'm not even tempted to send them. I mean, they might, in the back of their mind, have fantasies of going out and, you know, cruising the hockey rink circuit, but I wouldn't let them go, because I've been there, and I know what kind of life that is. And you don't send somebody who's a sub-teen into that world, not unless you're really deranged.
How about a young adult? Is it a kind of a world that's maybe best avoided at any age?
Or? Well, I mean, if you're a person who likes to go to hockey rinks to see shows, go. I mean, I think it's great if that's the form of entertainment that you want, but working there is another story, and dealing with the kind of people that you have to deal with on that circuit, that's not something that you want to send a young person out to do, because that ain't funny. That's serious business.
What turned you on to music in the first place?
I liked music.
Was there any specific artist that at first kind of was the catalyst?
The first thing that sent me into the world of music was by accident hearing some Arab music when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I heard it and loved it. I didn't know what it was. Neither did my parents. But I said, that's great, you know. That was the first thing that I heard that I liked. And the next thing that really impressed me was rhythm and blues. And at the point that I heard rhythm and blues, I said, I must get a record player. And that was it.
So, you started playing the drums first?
Yeah.
Particular reason? Was there an influence there? Was there a particular drummer?
Well, no. It's just some people have affinities for certain types of physical activities. Some people say, baseball, that's my life. You know, I crave it. Some people say, I want to play the drums. I like to beat on things, hear the sounds that come out, and do that with my body. You know, I like that. Other people say, I must play the guitar so I can make those faces and do that kind of stuff. And other people want to play the piano, and some people will actually want to play a violin. You never know. You know? Oh, some people like to jog. You just, one day you wake up and you say, that's what I want to do, and you go do it. Who knows? It's biochemical, Rex.
So when did the writing come in? I have you placed at the drums at 12 and writing at 14, but not the schedule.
Right, that's true.
Okay, now we got you as an R&B fan as a kid, starting on playing drums. And I said you started writing more, you know, orchestral pieces than four rhythm things. So that seems kind of unusual.
Well, it's only unusual in America because people in America don't have anything. They don't care about that kind of stuff, you know. They don't want unusual things in America, for one thing. They want everything to be exactly the same. It's almost like America wishes it was Russia or it was Red China. They crave uniformity here. All levels of government crave uniformity. All levels at the corporate in that scene, they want uniformity. Everybody wants it. Even the people who would be made uniform seem to desire uniformity. In order for something to be good, it has to be the same as somebody else's thing. That's why it's all this copycat TV shows, copycat records, copycat movies. It's boring. So, yeah, it's unusual if you do something that nobody else is doing. That doesn't make it bad, though.
Well, actually, I guess my question is, how did you learn to do it when without any kind of formal training? Am I correct in that you didn't, you know, study with?
I went to the library. You listen to records and went to the library. You can find out a lot of stuff for free.
I don't let this out. So where was it? What part of America?
That was in California. I started playing the drums when I was living in Monterey. And I started writing when I was in San Diego. Huh?
Yeah,
who's it, Rex?
You know what's funny? Since every time I go into like a different city, somebody, we drive past the building, someone says, that's where Frank Zappa went to high school. You know?
Not true.
I know. The thing is, I was wondering about, you know, Joe seemed to be leading up to, is there anything in your past that, like, people have misunderstandings about, you know, like, where you were here and what you did on stage and,
oh, yeah, there's plenty of those. I mean, I'm always accused of eating shit on stage by various people. And, you know, people make references to some famous gross-out contest or stepping on baby chickens and all that stuff. And these are all products of deranged, drug-crazed hippies' imaginations because my stock answer to eating shit is simply this. The closest I ever came to eating shit was at a Holiday Inn buffet in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And that was not intentional, I'll assure you. And as far as doing those kinds of things on stage, no, I do not do those things. I have no desire to, and where anybody would have come up with that is beyond my imagining. And as far as baby chickens goes, that's Alice Cooper's department.
Have you been puzzled by this kind of occult following and stories that have built up like this, this thing like YME?
No, but I have to attribute a lot of this to either bad mental health, which is one of the world's great problems today, or pure ignorance, which has been fueled by an educational system that breeds more ignorance. You know, when you have people who are not too bright to begin with going into a school that intends to keep you dumb so you'll buy things that are worthless, then you can't be surprised at anything that they say or do. You know, how can you logically be surprised? People are just not prepared to deal with facts anymore.
The people, though, that do you ever find those, some of these people wind up as part of your constituency? I mean, however reluctantly you might accept them.
Well, I'm not here to pick and choose who consumes what I do. You know, I mean, if somebody derives pleasure from it, I think that's great. You know, no matter what their persuasion is. I went to a club which is now defunct in England called the Speakeasy, which used to be the place where all the rock and roll people went to hang out. And there used to be a group called The Flock. Did you ever hear of them? They used to record for Columbia, right? Okay. So I'm standing in the Speakeasy. This guy comes up to me and introduces himself as a member of The Flock, and they've just released their first album, blah, blah, blah. It's so great to meet you. You know, is it true that you ate shit on stage and blah, blah, blah? And so I said, no, that's not true. Well, the guy was heartbroken. He wanted to believe that that's, you know, the kind of person I was. And here he was talking to a shit-eating guy in an English nightclub, you know. And when I disavowed this, he just kind of hung his head and walked away like I'd broken his heart or something. No, I hate to disappoint people. You know, if they're looking for that kind of syndrome, they should go elsewhere.
It's probably like the famous toilet poster that people like.
People see a poster of somebody sitting on a toilet and they think they eat shit on stage. Well, that goes to show you how our educational system has failed in the logic training department. You know, that's a pretty big quantum leap from a picture of a person sitting on a toilet to images of the person earning his living on stage eating doo-doo. That's, I want to see the math involved in coming to that conclusion.
Well,
Rex.
Rex. Let's talk about video.
Okay.
Exploding here in the States, finally. I've been used commercially in Europe for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of usage is really starting to happen here. You have kind of a veteran video artist, you know, done it a long time ago. I was kind of curious what you might think of what you see now. Do you see, you know, somebody like TV, that kind of thing?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what I think. Here are the dangers of what's happening with MTV and other things of that nature. It's kind of a mechanical fact of life that what you see tends to take precedence over what you hear. When you're looking at a film, you can live with a reduced bandwidth in the soundtrack if the pictures are impressive, you know, because you're getting more stimulation from the eye than from the ear. And what happens in the case of videos prepared for broadcast is that people tend to pay more attention to what it looks like than what it sounds like, which means they're not listening to music anymore. I watch MTV and I see, here's what I see. I see a pictorial vocabulary of 30 to 40 pictorial hooks, which are used over and over again, just the same way as cliches in pop music and the audio on the audio side. You see the same types of images used by every group in a very formula way. It's this like tiny language of symbolisms. It's kind of like cave painting. You know, these three lines equals the buffalo. You get it? All right? Oh, these two lines over here equal girlfriend. She goes away. It's all these dumb norms are being perpetuated, okay? And then you think, well, what did I hear? And I can't remember any tunes. I can remember all those pictures, you know. The girl slams the car door. Big shot of the girl's lips going like that. The girl disappears, you know. But there's all these things that keep being done over and over and over again, and you don't remember the music. And if everybody goes crazy for this video revolution, what are they doing? Everybody's becoming a little pictorial cliche producer, and what happens to the music? I like music. I don't need to see anything while I listen to music. I'd rather just hear it. But we're going into a phase now where everybody's bypassing the listening process to get into the video of it all. That's what's happening.
Could there be a happier marriage?
Yeah, there could be. But unfortunately, the videos are made not for the purpose of happier marriages. They're made as 4-minute commercials to sell albums. That is the sole purpose of those videos. And as long as the things are conceived and executed by people with a mercantile mentality, you're not going to have the happy marriage. What you're going to have is more and more efficient promos, because that's why the things are made. It costs a lot of money to make them. Why is anybody going to put any money into it unless it sells records? They all hope it will sell records. Unfortunately, it hasn't been demonstrated that they do. Some places, yes. Other places, it's pretty vague whether or not the money spent on those clips really does what it's intended to do. Those people are not setting out to make art. They're setting out to sell records. And they now have a medium that will allow them to show 4-minute, 5-minute commercials for an album. That's what it is.
One of the classic promos was made under the auspices of your straight B part.
Which?
The one that never got on television for Decals.
Decals was not a straight record. That was Warner Brothers.
That was Warner Brothers? Mm. I thought that was on the straight record. Mm. Well, anyway, you know, that wound up being shown at the Museum of Modern Art, but TV wouldn't touch it.
Mm. Well, that's the way history works. What is it, dear?
Call room service and tell them that they're far too late.
Can I shoot for one more?
One more.
You know, we talked about all these, you know, perceptions, you know, that have been passed down about you. I wonder how you, about your self-image. Do you see yourself as a regular guy? Or do you think you're a little... Obviously, we're going to talk about that concept.
Well, I think that Americans always like to think of themselves as regular guys. It's part of their ideal, of their aesthetic ideal. Americans wish that they're all regular guys and gals. I don't care whether I am or not. I know that what I do is different, and I know that the way I live is different, and the way I think is different, and that neither makes it better or worse than anybody else. I know that it's just apart from the way other people conduct themselves. And I don't expect to change, nor do I wish anybody to change to accommodate me. But I do take exception with mass desires to be nice guys and gals, because the people who strive for that are living for a fantasy that they will never achieve. Nature didn't make people to be nice and normal and uniform like that. Sameness is not enforceable.